Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. Chris Matthews is our guest this hour. In addition to reading Chris's book, a good chunk of it last night, I was also finding myself listening to speeches by Jack Kennedy, particularly the remarks he made when he went to Ireland, and it just brought back a lot, you know. It brought back my family, Irish Catholic family, and Ireland, and that time in American history. Like Chris, I find myself drawn to just about everything written about Jack Kennedy, and Chris has written really a very, very thorough book. The title of it is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. He says in the intro he wanted to get every possible look at him, see him from any angle that would help explain him. Was he a liberal, as he's been tagged, or was he a pragmatist, open to liberal causes? Was he a rich boy, pushed by his dad, buying into what his father had sold him on, or was he a self-made leader? Was he a legacy or a Gatsby? The whole JFK had begun to exert on my imagination and on my curiosity when I was a young boy, never abated, and instead it only increased with the passing decades, thus this book. And you know Chris. We all know Chris. Chris is the host of Hardball. He was a Peace Corps volunteer, too, and we're going to play a little bit later on this hour of Kennedy's thoughts about the Peace Corps and urging people to devote 2 years of their lives to service, that the higher ideal of what America is. Chris has also worked for Tip O'Neill. He had a front row seat as a top aide to the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and Tip had great stories about Kennedy as well because they knew each other. He's the author of 5 best-selling books, in addition to Hardball, How Politics is Played, Told by One Who Knows the Game, Kennedy and Nixon, and there's a lot of stuff about Kennedy and Nixon in this book and their relationship that I was not aware of, the rivalry that shaped post-war America. Now let me tell you what I really think, American Beyond Our Grandest Notions, and Life's a Campaign. Pain, and we're happy to have Chris with us this hour of the program, and we'll welcome phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Chris.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen.
Oh, it's so strange to hear you because I watch you all the time, and it is so
well,
strange
this is
to
real
hear
me,
you.
Not the TV me.
Yeah, good, good. Here's the real Chris Matthews. So you started. I love the book. It's filled with so much information, and I know a lot about Kennedy too because my background, Irish Catholic, is similar to yours. So my family worshipped him. But I didn't know a lot about his relationship with Nixon and his incredible illnesses and his love of history. You've just filled me in on a lot. And you, I'm interested in you being a paper boy in 1960, and you decided all of a sudden you're going to start reading the papers you're delivering, and you're captivated by JFK.
Well, yeah, my family was kind of divided. I mean, we're a Republican family. Classic, second generation. My grandmother was Northern Irish Protestant. The rest of the family is real Catholic Irish. My grandfather was an English chauffeur, had come over. So I've got the Trinity living in my own household. So we had conflict all over the place. My grandmother was more like, if you think Mrs. Doubtfire in the movie with Robin Williams,
right.
That's my grandmother in real life, with a thick Northern Irish accent and very Republican, actually. And the rest of the family, my grandfather's a Democratic committeeman in the North Philly area, a real urban area, Irish-Polish neighborhood, where everybody walked to church, to St. Stephen's. So we had that sort of neighborhood growing up. And then my father was very Republican, sort of classic, what Nixon would call a cloth-coat Republican. And so we had all those disputes. My mom, I think, secretly voted for Kennedy. My dad, I know, voted for Nixon. But it was, in those days, I don't think our parents, talked to each other about politics. They're very careful about, I know Dad's best friend was Gene Shields, and I don't think in the 40 years they were known as spick and span for playing golf together, playing cards together, they ever talked politics. So, but it was there, and I was totally caught up, and that was the last real election where people wore skimmer hats and wore big buttons, and you had rallies in big cities where 500,000 or 1 million people would show up at lunchtime to meet Nixon with Eisenhower in the car with him, or Jack Kennedy coming through the suburbs. I remember seeing the motorcade of Jack Kennedy bombing through the suburbs of where we live, right on the Bucks County border from Philadelphia. It was so real, and the zest of it, I think that's the word I remember most, zest.
Yes.
It was in the air, as you know.
Yes.
In the air. The politics was in the air all around you.
Mm-hmm. It sure was. And he really, as you outline in the book, this guy really was a campaigner. He had at some point to go national with how to do a national campaign. But early on, the early House races, he was knocking on doors. He was realizing the value of women and going to tea parties. And he had this bad back and he was hurting like crazy. But he knocked on all those doors.
He said that, and he began to write his memoirs. He started to dictate to my figure. When the tape was made, but I got it out of the Kennedy Library. The tape he began around 60. I think it was at the time right after he'd begun his presidential campaign, and he was dictating his early beginnings, and he talked about the most important thing in politics he discovered was starting early. He said that, as an example, he said, look at Coca-Cola and look at Lucky Strike, the cigarette company. Everybody knows they exist, but you have to keep advertising. So his argument was you had to start real early, and he said the only way to win an election was laborious work. Like you just said, day to day, hour by hour, meeting people. He and Ted Sorensen were in that airplane together for 4 years, from 56 to 60. They met 30,000 people, and they had note cards on all of them, rating them 1 to 10 on how much they liked Kennedy. He really did incredible sweat work. He had sweat equity in that campaign, like I don't think anybody since.
Mm-hmm. And some of the book, I don't want to concentrate fully on it, but again, you're reminded how he almost died so many times.
Oh,
he was in excruciating pain.
Kathleen, it was
unbelievable.
I guess there's four or five things, icons that I've blasted in this book, but one of them was he had it made. Here was a kid who, in grade school, had scarlet fever. He got asthma. He thought he had leukemia. All through high school, he was getting his blood count checked all the time. His mother, by the way, never visited him the whole 4 years he was at Choate. That's another story that Jackie talked about in her interview with Teddy White about his mother never loving him. Mm. She loved being the ambassador's daughter, she loved being the mayor's daughter, but she didn't love Jack. And boy, there's a story. But he had this first episode of, he had the bad back even before the war. He should have never been allowed in the Navy with his bad back. He had to sleep on a table every night. He wore a brace, a corset. It was a sciatic belt he wore around him. One day he was running around in the South Pacific looking for some needle and thread so he could fix it. He had to wear that all the time. He had a stomach which was always in a knot that he could never figure out what it was. They thought it was leukemia, then they thought it was colitis. He was taking steroids for that, according to Robert Dowick. He did the work on that, the historian. So he had the first last rites was in 47. He was with Pamela Harriman on a trip over there, and he had his first episode. He had the last rites. He was almost dead. The doctor said he wouldn't live out the year. He had it again in 51 with Bobby when they were in the Far East, and Bobby basically saved his life. He got him to a military hospital in Okinawa. And then he had, of course, the bad back. Surgeries in 54, we had the last rites again. And that's where Nixon showed up there, where his driver, actually a Secret Service guy at the time, told me one day on the telephone, had a long talk with him. He said, you know, Nixon was crying. Nixon really liked, I mean, nobody wants to hear this. It just clashes with all we think about Nixon, but he had this real affection for Kennedy. And it went on right to the end. It was just sad, an almost unrequited affection for another person, and in this case, his rival.
Tell us the story. It's a fascinating story of the two of them in an early debate. I can't remember what the issue was, and they're taking a train. They're taking a train back.
I missed it. I love trains. I don't know about you,
Kathleen. I do, too.
I love trains.
Yeah.
I love the fact that they go from one place to another without turbulence.
Right.
They actually get there. You don't have to think you're going to get there. It's the one part of your life you're pretty sure of. Get on a train, and you will get there. And they took a train out to western Pennsylvania. The local congressman, a Republican, Frank Buchanan, had been asked by a local business and labor group, it was a local community group, to bring in to town the hottest shot Republican, the hottest shot freshman Democrat. So that was Nixon and Kennedy in that day. They had come in 46. So they took the train out together, the Capitol Limited, and they debated that night. And Nixon, of course, was Nixon. He was very vicious, actually, against the labor unions. Kennedy knew that Nixon had made the labor unions such perfect enemies. He knew he could concentrate on charming the business guys. So Kennedy went, knowing Nixon had razzed up his crowd, he knew he didn't have to do that. He went right for the business guys and said, you know, you even need to worry about the labor. Don't be too tough on them. So with the Taft-Hartley legislation, then they'd go out for hamburgers at the Star Diner near the train station. They catch the midnight train back. They flip a coin. or whatever for the bottom bunk. Nixon gets the bottom bunk. Kennedy gets the top bunk. And on through the night, for hours, they talk about the coming conflict with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, which got its name 2 weeks later from Bernard Baruch. Wouldn't you like to see that?
Yes, I sure would.
Wouldn't you like to watch these two guys debate just back from the war?
Yeah. And Kennedy gave a campaign contribution. Was it $1,000 to Nixon?
You know, there's a lot of dispute about the number. I basically came down, it was $1,000. My tip would tell stories that were just outlandish. $150,000. He would tell me these stories. That, I don't know where you get these numbers from. But I really sharpened it up with my research to $1,000, which was a lot of money then. I mean, look at the CPI index. I mean, a really tremendous amount of money. And he delivered it by hand over to Nixon's office. Yeah, Nixon was ecstatic. He said, imagine this. It's just ecstatic. And I did get the paper trail on that from his office people and from just different notes left in the Nixon library. And, no, it's an amazing story.
It is an amazing story. Let's talk about reading for a while, because he was so much informed, his idea of the world and maybe his desire to become a hero, by the people he read about. He read biographies. Churchill was his hero. Can you tell us more about that? Maybe because he was sick a lot. He did a lot of reading, but you got to read a lot to be an important person,
at the end,
I think.
He said that, near the end, he said Roosevelt used to get his ideas from conversation, and he got his ideas from reading. It started with my first seedling on this was Jackie Kennedy and what got into the Theodore White Life magazine piece right after he was killed. And she talked about him being a young, sick, lonely boy who was all alone and read about his heroes like Arthur and the Round Table. And I got into that idea. And then I, of course, got the notes from that interview, which were really devastating in many ways about what she thought about what caused Jack to be the way he was with women. I talked to Jean Kennedy Smith, his last surviving sibling, out at East Hampton last summer, and she was great. She said he was always so sick, and he was always reading, and that's what separated him from the rest of his brothers and sisters. He was an intellectual. The rest were all jocks. She said athletics and sports have been overrated for development. John Kennedy was the one member of our family that just read and read and read, and that made him what he was, which is exactly what Jackie said, that it was history made Jack. It's so romantic, the idea of a young, sick kid who was all alone. His parents had left him alone almost in a British sense in a boarding school, much like Churchill. And in that world of the bedroom with nobody around, he would read and read and read and find his heroes and find the world out there, the big world. He read the whole history of World War I, the World Crisis, by Winston Churchill at the age of 14.
My.
He was reading the New York Times, and I got one of his roommates, his classmates, Rip Horton, talked about how he would watch him read the New York Times every day, a high school kid. And he would lie in his bed and try to distill the truth from an article, sort of do an explication, and try to figure out what he could remember. The Kennedy brothers had one advantage. They had an old man who I didn't like much, but reading about him, but he instilled in them this ambition of the average intellect. He would tell them, I heard this at the Teddy Kennedy funeral, that he said, you're not brilliant kids. You're going to have to work harder than the brilliant kids. And it was such a wonderful thing to tell your kids. You're not geniuses.
Yes.
I think Jack's IQ was in the 120s. He was quite bright, intelligent. He was no whiz. But he really used his brain. And I think it began with that early reading.
Chris Matthews is our guest this hour, and his book, which has just been released, is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. For those of you who have a profound interest, and by golly, a lot of Americans do, interest in Jack Kennedy, you will really appreciate this book. Chris has been fascinated by him since 1960, when he was a paper boy. He was probably inspired to go into the Peace Corps, as I was, to become a VISTA volunteer because of Jack Kennedy. And it's really wonderful to read the book and to look at some of the clips of Kennedy in Ireland and conventions and as president, and listen to some of the speeches again. It's no wonder we remember him. So we're going to take phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Chris Matthews, our guest this hour, an interview I've been looking forward to, and his book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. We go to your phone calls. John in St. Germain is our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
All right, John.
Chris, I love your program. I actually like Rachel Maddow's program more, but that's because she's smarter than all of us.
That's probably true. She is a Rhodes Scholar. Let's not forget.
Once you asked why Rush Limbaugh kept on pulling at his polo shirt, and you asked for people to send in their ideas, and I'm a little overweight myself and wear polo shirts. The reason we do it is that the polo shirt gets caught in the folds of our gut. And that's why he does it. Anyway, back to Kennedy. The two questions I have is, how involved was Kennedy in getting us into the Vietnam War, and how did he struggle with that, if he did? And the other is about his picadillos that he may have gotten into, and did you write about that or do any research about those issues?
Well, let's start with Vietnam, and I was able to get the tape recordings of his dictation to the record. He, after President Diem was killed in that coup, which we had supported, in November of 63, right the last month he was alive, he felt terrible about that. He was in a very apologetic, grieving mode. You could hear him in the tape recording. He was dividing up his people, saying different. Michael Forrestal was for the coup, Averell Harriman, Henry Cavill Lodge was for it, the people against it, Bobby McNamara and some others. He talked about the people who were on the border. He was trying to win that war, help the Vietnamese win the war, rather. And so he was torn. His government was coming apart over that issue at the end. His people, the ones he trusted the most, were divided, deeply divided. I'd say the more cold-hearted people were for knocking off CM, and they didn't mind at all that he got killed, it seemed. Jack Kennedy was a very miserable man about the role he played in the death of CM. He felt that he had sent a cable over there in, at the 24th of August, which basically gave the go-ahead to his newly named ambassador, Henry Cabot Lodge, who he knew, and he said in his dictation, had his mind already set on knocking off CM, our ally over there, the president of South Vietnam. Now, he said that, but the blood-curdling part of it was that our ambassador, Henry Cabot Lodge, who I think was a very cold man, had breakfast the morning that he knew he was knocking off CM. So we were very much in the business, the realpolitik, of winning that war in a very ruthless way, knocking off our ally leader, because we never thought we could separate him from his brother and his sister-in-law, Madame Nu, the Dragon Lady. And there's all the assaults, the repression of the Buddhists that was going on at the time. And Kennedy knew in a country that was 90-some% Buddhist that the Catholic leader was already isolated by culture and religion, that it wasn't going to really succeed. But he was trying his best, and he deeply respected President Diem, Nicolas Diem, who he had supported as a member of the Friends of Vietnam going back to the 50s with a group led by Cardinal Spellman of New York. So Jack Kennedy was a conflicted man about that war. The best I can say about him getting us in, he certainly increased the number of advisors, military advisors, from under 2,000 to under 20,000. But he did, at the very end, make it very clear, no combat role. In fact, Red Fay, his old war buddy from PT days, recalled being on an American ship during naval exercises, and Kennedy got a call from one of his unit leaders over there saying that an outfit leader wanted to take his outfit into combat because he saw an opportunity for Americans to win a fight over there. And Kennedy said, tell him that if he engages in combat, I'm cutting the funding for the entire regiment he's involved in. Kennedy was really determined to keep us out of combat. That said, the last day he was alive at Fort Worth, he said, if we pull out of that country, that government falls tomorrow. Mm. Saigon falls tomorrow. Ted Sorensen, one of the most honest men I've ever met, who died recently, said in his last book that he didn't know what Jack would do. Michael Forrestal said he had been given a command by the president, his national security advisor, to come up with a plan, a number of options, including an exit. The best I can say is that starting in 1951, sir, and then in 54, he made it clear he thought the French could not win the battle against the Viet Minh. He made it clear that no matter how many troops they sent in, they were going to lose because nationalism would prevail. I think he understood the force of nationalism. I think he was not a gross man. He wasn't like Lyndon Johnson. He wouldn't have poured a 500,000 troops into that country. He was an elegant man. He probably would have sought something like the coalition government, which they received. They were able to win, thanks to Harriman, with the Soviet Union over at Laos, and something that would have papered over our retreat. I think that's what he would have liked to have done. But in all fairness, come 1965, when we saw that government fall, would he have gone in then or let it fall and taken the rap for the reputation for losing, in the words of the old days, losing China, losing Vietnam? It's a hard call. I can only say that his penchant was not for a gross military engagement, because in the entire presidency, he never really committed a combat troop to action.
How do you explain how he could be so thoughtless and some might say cruel to have his wife be 8 months pregnant, lose the child? She's obviously in agony physically and emotionally, and he's off on vacation.
Well, Kathleen, it was worse than that. And this is where you have to understand the, we all do, the complexity of people. Here's a man who risked his life for his crew. I could tell that story to the point of tears, what he did to save the life of
Patrick McMahon. It's quite a story, yeah.
His sense of responsibility to his friends, going back to high school days, to Lem Billings, who never left his side, to Chuck Spaulding, to Charlie Bartlett, to Ben Bradley. His friends were real friends. His loyalty to other guys, if you will, was really total. He was relatively ruthless about his staff people. He could interchange them, replace them without a lot of concern. He could be tough with people working for him. With his wife, it's just one of the confounding, elusive questions I'll ask as long as I live, which is, Jacqueline Kennedy was spectacular. I mean, just in aesthetic terms for guys, I'm a regular guy, just the most beautiful woman you can imagine. It took, I said in my thing in the book, two eyes to see both of her eyes. I mean, it's just to look at her was to be stunned. She was elegant, well-educated, in every way well-turned out. Charming, a wonderful sort of old world wife, if you will. In other words, a spouse that knew how to make a man happy. She did everything right that I could figure to woo him, to win him, and to keep him. And yet, he began his unfaithfulness, his infidelity early on, and it doesn't show in the pictures. I mean, I've gone back and looked at the 54 pictures when they were playing football in Dumbarton Oaks, looking like the youngest, most perfect, pre-regal but gorgeous young couple you'd ever imagine. And he was already out and about. He was already in terrible pain with his back, too, another thing he didn't show. And it just is a fact. He was cruel with her, with not coming back from the south of France when he was over there with the French girls chasing women in the south of France, and she knew it. And he never came back when she had the miscarriage. And our religion is, you know, Kathleen, when you have these late pregnancies that end in miscarriage, I mean, I went out to the Kennedy grave a few weeks ago, and there it was, a grave for that child they lost. They lost a child at 56, and he never came back until George Smathers, says his buddy from the Congress, said, "You better get back home or you're going to lose your marriage," and he finally went home. It's just so hard. Bobby told him not to come back at one point because she was so mad at him, he better not show up in that when she's in that experience still from losing the child. So, but later on, he showed new cruelty to her when he would engage in a pretty much open affair with Mary Meyer. And Jackie knew about it, and he would just bring her to the White House right in her face. And it's very hard to figure.
Right.
And then a lot of people like to be sentimental and say at the end they came together after the loss of Patrick, the child that was born a few hours after birth in August of 63. But they didn't. He was still carrying on with other women. And I don't get it. I mean, I just don't get it. It's sad. It's tragic for her. It's part of the memory you have of him. And so when I write my little notes to Caroline, who I know a little bit, and I've been trying to keep her up to date with, I said, he's Henry V. He's a great hero with flaws.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great hero, but he has flaws. And this one about his marriage, it's just so hard to put together with everything that was so great about him.
Yeah, it is. Thanks, John, for your call. Jean in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
I'm wondering, could you talk about President Kennedy's legislative legacy?
Yeah.
Were there Democrats, Republicans, like they are today? No. Did he have cooperation? Just a comparison to the stonewalling Republicans who
Come
up on their own programs and agendas for various reasons.
Yeah, well, it's brutal today. As you know, they're almost a phalanx against him. If they don't get 200 votes, they're not going to move at all. They won't give him part of their caucus. In other words, he can't engage. Our president today cannot engage with the Republicans and get some of their support unless he gets all of it, which means no deal for the Democrats. It's a horrible model going on right now. What Jack was doing, Jack Kenny was doing at the end, was he was fighting for about four pieces of legislation. One was the most powerful, I think, for all of us today, civil rights. He had gotten it into the Judiciary Committee. Of course, he introduced the bill in June of 63 in that dramatic speech about civil rights being as fundamental as the Constitution, as deep as the Bible. And he just, for the first time, said, we're going to do this thing about public accommodations. No more white-only businesses, white-only restaurants and gas station men's rooms and that stuff. That's going to go. So he was fighting, and I have him on tape, actually, in the book, using Dick Daley, the boss of Chicago, the mayor of Chicago, putting pressure on a liberal member of the committee of judiciary who was trying to get a perfect bill. Jack was trying to get a bill. And he's also doing the same with the mayor of Philly, putting pressure on Congressman Tal, who was my congressman then. So clearly he was working hard, working the phones, working power, and he was moving it along, but he was facing a stonewall Dixiecrat on the Rules Committee, and the Rules Committee was holding him up then. So what he was facing then was not Republicans, who weren't so bad, actually, on civil rights. I mean, Everett Dirksen, of course, ended up leading all but two Republicans to support the bill the following year in the Senate. But these Dixiecrats, who were Democrats, but they were segregationists. And he was fighting like heck with these people, and they came from states like Virginia as well as the Deep South. And well, he also was pushing for Medicare, and he was pushing for a tax cut, which business was opposing at the time. And Jack Kenny was under the influence of Walter Heller of Minnesota, the great macroeconomist out there at the University of Minnesota, and he believed in a tax cut to end what he called fiscal drag. He wanted the economy to move, and he was trying to get the unemployment rate down below 5%. So he was a liberal on the economy by the lights of those days, trying to get a tax cut through a recalcitrant Republican Party that didn't believe in tax cuts. That's just how times have changed.
Yeah.
But he was pushing, and I can't say whether he would have gotten these programs through, like Medicare, civil rights, the tax cut, the things he really believed in. But that, they were, of course, all passed under Johnson. That was the Johnson program, what Kennedy had initiated.
I'm interested in civil rights issues, and I was interested in how he handled the University of Mississippi James Meredith case, which I want you to describe. But I just watched recently, which you've probably seen, the Harry Belafonte documentary, who talked about how Kennedy really, who he supported, but said that he was quite a reluctant champion of civil rights.
Well, you can argue that, but, you know, I mean, it's the time. Here he is coming in after Eisenhower, whose greatest regret was naming Earl Warren to the court. And, of course, Earl Warren did probably the greatest landmark decision ever, Brown case, on separate but equal. But let me just tell you the facts. I said a lot of the Kennedy record was on record. It's there. I mean, he sent federal troops into Ole Miss when he knew that the National Guard down there was not going to help him, when the state troopers were not going to help him. He had the governor down there, Ross Barnett, right in his face saying, I'm not going to help get James Meredith enrolled here. He had to go incredibly strong. He did the same thing in humiliating, basically, George Wallace, sending in Nick Katzenbach into Alabama to that university. He was tough, and he put it to these guys, and he got it done. And when Mrs. King got the call from him in the fall of 60, he put himself on record with the King, the whole King mission down there. And he and Bobby got him out of jail, and King out of jail. And from that day forward, they were working with him. Of course, he was moving carefully, because at that time, the Democratic Party was based in the South. He had to carry Texas. He had to carry Georgia. At the very end of his life, he was trying to hold on to Texas. He knew how angry they were about the civil rights push by him. And so he was, I think, a bold warrior for civil rights, and I think the record will show that.
Yeah. I know that you joined the Peace Corps, and I imagine that Kennedy had a lot to do with that. I want to play a little bit of a clip of Kennedy talking about the Peace Corps, and then it is really a lasting legacy on his part. How many people were in public service who did what he suggested? Here he is talking about the Peace Corps.
The Peace Corps is really the idea of the American people. When I talked last fall about the idea of young American men and women going abroad to serve shoulder to shoulder with the citizens of newly emerging countries, a tremendous response went up from the schools and colleges of the United States. In the last few months, more applications for the Peace Corps have come to us than have come for positions in all the rest of the United States government put together. What is remarkable is that there is no salary for the members of the Peace Corps. They will go abroad and live on the same standard as people of other countries. that they will work with them 2 or 3 years, devoting part of their lives to peace and to strengthening the ties that bind men together all over the globe, who are capable and well-trained, and who will be welcomed by other countries.
Now, there was an inspirational program you joined.
So it's just as he said, and one of the great moments I discovered in the book was he and his war buddy again, Red Fay, out at the Palace Hotel on Market Street in San Francisco. He was ready to give a big speech to the Cow Palace, and he was talking about how the race was getting close, and he was getting worried about Eisenhower helping Nixon basically pass him on the inside lane, and he was really afraid he might lose. And he said, "But let me tell you about my speech I'm giving tonight." And here are these two war buddies, and he was just relishing to tell Red Fay about the Peace Corps, how he's going to lay it out and explain what it's all about. How guys like him and women of the same age would go off and not kill people, but go off into the third world and basically show them the best of America. And it was so wonderfully Jack Kennedy. Adventure, high adventure, travel, getting out there in the world, having some fun, actually. I used to say when I was in the Peace Corps, what would Jack Kennedy do? You know, he'd have some fun. And, you know, we had motorcycles, and I was, you know, bopping around Africa. I hitchhiked all the way through up East Africa by myself with just a thumb out there, all through Kenya and Rhodesia and up through Tanzania and Mozambique. I mean, it was Hemingway country. I mean, to be able to go to Mozambique by just on the weekend heading over to the Portuguese colony and the sidewalk cafes and the whole thing, and to see Africa in the bush, to be out there completely alone with just, you're the only white person there, to put it bluntly, the only person that looks like you they've ever seen in many cases, the Swazis, where I was with Swaziland. And I did tell this story, which I found so romantic, of a friend of mine, a buddy of mine in the Peace Corps, Steve Hank. He's now a professor at UNO, the University of New Orleans. He teaches film down there, and he took his people out on the village from the village that night, and they sat out on this hillside, and he was a really smart guy, and he said, "I want you to watch for something," and a light started to move across the horizon at night, in the dark night, and it was us going to the moon.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, and the Swazis believe the power of the moon, you know, the witch doctors, the king, all the mad, the Mutsi, it comes from the moon, and the deep belief in the moon and its power, and to have us going there. And later on, they sent a piece of the moon to the King Sabuza of Swaziland. But the primordial nature of the people, the human race, going to another place, a satellite of Earth, and doing it and showing it to people who are living basically in the Stone Age, and to share that with them as sort of a magical night together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said in the book that his Saturn rocket, which he had so much faith in, had done its work, but so had the Peace Corps.
Yeah. And so many people, it really had a profound impact even on today, Chris. I can't tell you, and you know more of these people than I do, how many people who were governors or who do public service work who served in the Peace Corps or who were VISTA volunteers. There are tons of them.
And they say, they're with their friends, it changed their life.
Yes, exactly.
Because it broke
exactly.
them out of the rut they had lived in. Mm-hmm. The religion they'd been brought up in, they began to see other religions. They began to see other people.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't see the whole world as bipolar, us in the Soviet Union at that time.
Yeah.
They saw it from another perspective, and they understood that as different as people are, and they are different in many ways, they are still people. And the power, I would go stay overnight with a local business guy. They treated me like their son, these African business guys.
Mm.
And here I am, a skinny white kid with long hair on a motorcycle arriving at a local store, teaching them how to run their businesses. And these guys inevitably would get me what they called a cold drink. They spoke in that sort of lingua franca of English and Zulu, and they'd go, "Oh, you want a cold drink?" and then they'd get me, even if they didn't have a refrigerator, which they didn't have a lot of times, they would give me a Coke, you know. The first thing they would do, and then they'd find me a chair. That was another thing. They knew white guys like chairs. It's one of those funny things. We used to always laugh because no matter the most primitive village you go into, and somewhere out of nowhere they would have a chair for the white guy. It was so innocent and so positive. And they just had no experience with America before we'd gotten there. And the British had just given them their independence. They had won their independence a couple months before. And we got to speak Zulu or Swazi, which is pretty much the same language. And I can't tell you how nice they were to us.
Yeah.
It's just so overwhelming,
yeah.
People.
And for me, it was VISTA. I became a VISTA volunteer and worked in the South, and it has forever informed how I look at so many issues as a journalist, you know?
Yeah.
To be with poor people, to understand poverty, it's forever informed my life. Yeah.
The funny thing is, back then, Kathleen, they had us as prep part of our experience. We were in a former black college down in the college that closed down. We were in somewhere in Baker, Louisiana, for training, learning language. And one of the things they had us do was live with an African-American family for a week. It's so anachronistic now. It seems so funny. But the idea of getting used to living with Africans. So let's have them live with some African-Americans.
Right. Right.
It was so innocent and so positive, but it seems bizarre today.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's just funny. It's just, it was totally harmless, but it was great.
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, let's go to, we have tons of emails. Ken in Verona, could you please, Chris, illuminate on Joe Kennedy's influence on the 1960 presidential election?
Well, I tell you, his influence on his son wasn't that great. I mean, Jack broke with him over the Second World War. I mean, he didn't believe in the Second World War. Jack fought in it. His older brother was killed in it. And so the brothers were very much not the old man in that regard. They thought Nazism was awful. In fact, Joe was told a friend, a guy I interviewed, a classmate in his 90s, told me how he said, "I'm going over there to kill Nazis. I'm going to get them in their bullpen," which he ended up getting killed doing off the coast of France when his plane blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack was just as different from his old man as you could be. He thought Churchill was right. Chamberlain was wrong. His old man was wrong. They should have been prepared to fight the Nazis. By 60, Joe Kennedy, it's kind of murky, his role. He certainly had tons of money. He raised a lot of money. He got some mob money, clearly. And I never quite figured that out, except in the Machiavellian sense. If you get the mob behind you, then you get them invested, then they're going to root for you. But that's kind of murky still. I couldn't get any new material there on that. I mean, Joe Kennedy was there. I think this TV series that ran on Reels was fun drama and a good soap, but way overplayed his role. I mean, Joe Kennedy didn't understand politics. He was very good with money, obviously, and very good with public relations. He could influence the movie industry. He could get newsreels of his son and his war experiences and heroism playing in the local theaters during his race for Congress. But I've never been able to crack through what good he did. I mean, he boosted the confidence of his kids. He kept saying, "You're going to make it." They'd give a bad speech. He said, "No, you were great." He kept them up all the time. I don't have anything new about Joe. My book is about the growth of one person and how he grew from Joe Kennedy's son to being the guy who got us through the Cuban Missile Crisis. That Bildungsroman is my role model for that, is to get a series of events in his life, in high school, in the Navy, in his early political career, that showed how he could grow as a political figure and as a leader who could have the detachment from people like Curtis LeMay and his father to make the critical decision that saved us from a nuclear war in 62.
Yeah.
That was my role in writing this book.
Let's talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis for a moment. You write, Bobby Kennedy offered the sharpest assessment of what his brother had done. The final lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis is the importance of placing ourselves in the other country's shoes.
Yes. Jack Kennedy tried to figure out what Khrushchev was up to when he put those 90-some missiles down in Cuba in 1962 secretly. He realized it was probably for strategic advantage because we had outnumbered them dramatically in the number of missiles we had, intercontinental missiles, to go to the Soviet Union. So they wanted to balance that off by having some missiles, intermediate missiles, in Cuba that which could reach New York. It wasn't defensive. It was offensive. He knew that. And what he had to realize was that Khrushchev meant business. Khrushchev had made it clear to him he wasn't afraid of a nuclear war, which is something you have to take into account here. He was not afraid of a nuclear war. So Kennedy decided he wasn't going to do what General LeMay wanted, that Admiral Shoup wanted him to do, what McGeorge Bundy and Doug Dillon and Dean Acheson, all the Cold Warrior hawks, wanted him to do, which was to attack. They wanted to go in and have a total invasion of Cuba. What he didn't know, but which was so important in history, is there were actually 43,000 Soviet troops and advisors on the island of Cuba, not 10,000 as they thought.
Wow.
If we were going to send in 150,000 troops, it would have been a war in Cuba on the ground. But far more frightening are two other factors. In Khrushchev's memoirs, he said that if he had one or two missiles left after an American attack on his missiles deployed there, he was going to hit New York. And he said, "I may not kill everybody in New York, but I teach America what it's like to fight a war on its own territory." He was cold-blooded in his determination, if he had to hurt us bad.
Mm.
Number two, he warned Kennedy before the Cuban Missile Crisis that if we moved on Cuba, this is a very directed threat, he was going for Berlin. Now, Kennedy saw how Khrushchev had grabbed the Hungarian Revolution and basically killed it at the time the British and the French had gone into Suez. So he knew how they knew this sort of moral offset. They knew they could get away with certain things in the world, the world's judgment, if they bounced them off against what the world thought was a bad move by the West. So he was afraid that the minute we moved on Cuba, he'd grab Berlin. And then with the overwhelming advantage of the Red Army and the Warsaw Pact troops, 350,000 to our combined NATO force of 15,000 in West Berlin, that we would immediately have to go, or within hours, to first use of nuclear weaponry just to ward them off. And so he could see the chain reaction that Barbara Tuchman had written about in World War I in the Guns of August, how each side did what it thought it had to do in its national interest, but back and forth, the chain reaction would lead to Armageddon. And so he had to stop that clock. Mm-hmm. And what he did was said, we're not going to invade.
Mm. And where did he get this idea of restraint? If everybody's advising him to go full force, was he informed by his war experience? Or
I think
what?
It was the he had a minimal respect for brass, for the scrambled eggs guys in the war. He used to talk about the big fat generals and admirals coming to visit them when they were in the front lines in the Solomons. But also the experience, the critical experience, the learning experience of the Bay of Pigs. He realized in the Bay of Pigs that Lemnitzer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and that Alan Dulles, the CIA director, were not operating in his interests, but in their own. They did not warn him of the most important questions he should have asked himself in the Bay of Pigs. All he needed to be told by his advisors in the Bay of Pigs was, how many Cuban troops are going to be there the day that our 1,500 exiles land on the beach at the Bay of Pigs? How many troops will be there to meet them within 24 hours? And the answer was 25,000 regular troops. Against 1,500 irregulars. Mm-hmm. They were going to get destroyed. They were not going to be able to form a beachhead. And he was also misled into believing they could easily escape into the mountains. There was 80 miles of swamp there. They couldn't have gotten, through. So clearly he was lied to. He knew that the people around him were inherited from Eisenhower. They were not his people. For the first time in his life in 61, he had people around him who were not Kennedy people. He had built his political career starting in 46 in that first race by building his own political party, building it statewide in 52, building it nationwide in between 56 and 60. And this is the first time he had people around him who weren't really Kennedy people, who weren't interested in him. They had their own purpose, which was to loop him into using American power against Castro. That was their trick. They were going to get those guys on the beach and then tell him, well, we got to go in to protect those guys. And he wouldn't do it at that point. So he learned then, at that moment, he said, no, you didn't win this one. These guys are going to get killed on that beach and caught, but I'm not engaging us in a Third World War because you guys think it's a good idea. Mm. And by 62... he and Bobby, who he trusted innately, and McNamara could see what they're up against, and they fought the military establishment and the Cold War establishment and saved the world. I absolutely believe, if you look at all the history we've been able to uncover and all the records and memoirs, if we had gone into Cuba and attacked, Khrushchev would have gone to war with us.
So he saved the world.
So I believe, and I believe the record shows that.
Chris Matthews, our guest. The book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
Chris Matthews, our guest. The book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Here's another email, Chris, from Michael. I graduated a year ahead of Chris from Holy Cross and knew him there from many late nights discussing topics. Chris talked a lot then, too. I grew up in the South where Irish Catholics were a minority. The election of Jack Kennedy was an event much like the later civil rights movement. Because it showed a Catholic could reach the highest office in the country. When he was killed, it had a profound effect on Irish Catholic Holy Cross. I wonder if Chris could talk about his experience. Class stopped, the whole school went to the chapel, and we wandered in a fog for several days.
Well, I will never forget it, Kathleen. It's like this morning. It just happened. Pat Monahan once said to me, we've never gotten over it, and And then he put it, looked at me, and he said, "You've never gotten over it." Mm. I mean, Pat was a soulful guy, and made me so happy that he sort of enlisted me in the ranks that day. Look, I remember I was going to check my mail at Holy Cross up in Worcester, and it's a Jesuit school, all men at the time. And I went to check my mail, and some kid came up to me, kind of a, I don't really respect him much these days. When I think about what he said, "I'll bet you $5 Jack Kennedy was just killed." I don't know what he was thinking.
Ooh.
And I went over to my world history class with Jim Powers, really tough class, and he just said, "Look, if you want to leave now, there won't be any cut counted against you. You only had 3 cuts a year you were allowed in a semester." So he said, "You don't have to stay." But some of the guys stayed, which is kind of amazing. They're real grinds. I went down to the basement of one of the dormitories, Carlin Hall, and turned on the TV and watched Cronkite the rest of the day, mm-hmm. right to the night. Mm-hmm. So that was my way of dealing with it. I remember a woman stopping me on the way home that weekend, I guess, in New York, Port Authority or somewhere. I was taking the bus, I think it was, and she said, "You must be very sad up there." I think the woman was Jewish, and it's so interesting about the way the different groups. I think the Jewish people, for example, were so taken with Kennedy, the Jack Kennedy experience, more as much as the Irish Catholics, I think, and black people too. I think there was a sense of everybody getting through the door at once. He was carrying the banner for so many people and breaking through that sort of white Protestant monopoly on the American presidency. It meant so much, so much. And I think as much as the Barack Obama's election, if not more, it just changed everything. And people felt, and the great thing about Jack Kennedy was always a we, it was never a he. He wasn't a star that way. Everybody, it was always ask not what the country can do for you. It was always bringing us in, whether the Peace Corps, VISTA, or the Special Forces, or rooting for the moonshot, or getting involved with 50-mile hikes, or whatever it was. There was this sense of we can do this together. It was always a we. It was the profound advantage he had over, I think, our current president. It was always we, not we have a star as president with a high IQ. No, we have a leader as president, mm-hmm. a skipper. Mm-hmm. And you felt the fact that you were on his crew. And it was a wondrous mm-hmm. ability to lead the people, to lead men and women into battle. And I think that sense of war effort, he brought mm-hmm. it from World War II, and never complain, never explain, just let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was poetic. And it is true, that breakthrough, because I come from a very Irish Catholic family, and they worship John Kennedy, and for the first time I saw the Eternal Flame. We took a group of listeners to Washington last spring. And Chris, I just stood, I was sobbing, and it was for all of it. You know, it was for the breakthrough, it was for Kennedy, it was for my Aunt Margaret, it was for my parents, it was for everybody, but it was just, it took it out of me. It was just profound.
Oh, it made us proud. You know,
right.
I go by every night, one of the best things about working in Washington all these years and living there is I'll drive back from something downtown at night, some ambassador's thing, something I'm so thrilled to be at, actually. And I'll drive by along the Potomac, and I always look for that little glistening light.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to see sometimes in the summer when there's so much trees and foliage, but you can just pick it out as you go by.
Mm.
I always look for it.
Yeah. Let's go to one quick call. Terry in Rice Lake. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Chris, I enjoy your show very much, very much. But anyway, I thought I heard once that, you know, when JFK went to Dallas, that he went there to shore up his approval ratings. And I think his approval rating, what I remember hearing, was 59%.
They're pretty high by today's standards, yeah. I said he went to 83 after he admitted responsibility for the Bay of Pigs, 83 job approval.
Woo.
He went down there to, as I said a few minutes ago, he was worried about the power of the civil rights, pushing for civil rights was hurting him in the white South. Of course, blacks couldn't vote down there hardly at all, so it was the white Southern that he had to deal with. And he was trying to hold on to at least Texas and Georgia in the 64 race. He knew he needed both of them. He thought he did. So he's trying to hold on to the Yellow Dog Democrats, if you will, who would stay Democrat no matter what. And in the last conversation, he was trying to figure it out. He was driving to the airport with Jim Wright and John Conley. And he kept asking him as they went to the airport, you know, an hour before he's killed or less. And he was saying, "What's the story on this Dallas? Why is it so right-wing? What's going on down there? Fort Worth is still Democrat." And Jim, John Connolly explained to him it was the economy, that the Fort Worth was where people worked side by side in corrals and stockyards and factory floors. And over in Dallas, it was all high-rise office buildings with people in white shirts. And they identified with the management level on the floor above them. And they wanted to vote like the bosses and get ahead. And he was trying to figure out economically why they'd all gone so far right. I mean, Nixon carried Dallas by 65%. So it, well, he wasn't killed by a conservative. I don't want to say that. He was killed by an infatuated communist, I suppose, sympathizer, Lee Harvey Oswald, by all the evidence we have. But that mood was definitely toxic there. Mm-hmm. There was a mood of anger and hatred that was in the air, which I always think influences these assassination mm-hmm. situations.
Well, Chris, thank you ever so much. Thanks for all that went into this book, for all of it. You know what I'm saying. Thanks yeah. for asking that question and for all you've done. I really enjoyed it, and I really like you, too.
Well, you've been a great – this is one of my best – I think it's my favorite interview so far, but I think you understand the sensibility of this, and I think kids need to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know about it.
And read the book. They need to read the book.
If they're still alive, need to remember that they were right.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. Chris Matthews. The book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks for getting all those JFK clips. And thank you for listening.